Let's move on then to State versus Jones. If counsel could please step forward. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. Assistant Atlantic County Prosecutor Melinda Harrigan on behalf of the state.
Good morning, Your Honors. Deputy Attorney General Evgenia Sitnikova is amicus curiae for the Attorney General.
Morning, Your Honors. Rochelle Watson, Deputy Public Defender 2, on behalf of Mr. Jones.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Please be seated. Ms. Harrigan, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, and may it please the Court. Before I begin with my opening statement, I would like to request 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
Thank you. Your Honors, the Appellate Division's reversal of the second attempted murder conviction in this case was error for two very important reasons. First, not only did the Appellate Division take too grudging a view of the state's circumstantial evidence, but it also ignored this court's analysis in State versus Perez regarding the close link between a defendant's criminal purpose and the substantial step requirement. And second, the Appellate Division committed further error when it held that the only inferences that could be drawn from the defendant's words in his telephone conversations from jail were that of his wishes and his disappointment that the victim was still alive, thereby negating the jury's weighing of the evidence and ultimately holding that the state's theory of the case was wrong. In this case, the state presented and the jury heard defendant's own words in conversations between him, his cousin, and his girlfriend from jail. The defendant's words were said with intent. The defendant stated, "The bitch should have been dead already." The defendant's words were also spoken with a purpose to ensure that the victim could not testify against him. In one phone call, the defendant demanded, "Did you call KG?" His cousin responded, "No, I never called KG." Defendant demanded, "Yeah, man, you got to call that N-word." His cousin responded, "Well, what am I saying to KG? You said ask him about the car." The defendant then states, "Yeah, tell him about the car and tell him what happened with me in court, like he's supposed to. Like, what the F are people still walking around for?" In a subsequent call, the defendant admitted, "I have reached out to him and told him what I need fixed." The jury heard these words along with other similar telephone conversations and ultimately determined that these conversations evidenced a plan already in motion, a plan to have the victim killed so that she could not testify against him because the defendant saw her in the courtroom. With defendant's words in mind, one of the main purposes of the Code's criminal attempt statute is to ensure that a person who acts with a purpose of committing a crime does not escape punishment merely because the crime was not completed. The criminalization of attempt focuses on the intent of the actor to cause a criminal result. In other words, and especially in this case, Your Honors, the law of attempt serves to ensure that one who acts with a specified level of culpability and a required criminal purpose is punished for that behavior, whether or not the criminal result is achieved. Here, the state proved that it was defendant's conscious object to have the victim killed by multiple and repetitive phone calls, each always inquiring the same thing: why is she still alive? Defendant stated, "Well, you just text him off that and tell him I said, man, he got it down, that dog." And there's no dispute in this case that the defendant wanted the victim dead. Thus, contrary to the Appellate Division's holding and the defense's argument to this court, defendant's words were not simply musings or his wishes. At no time does the defendant say, I wish she was dead, or I hope someone goes and kills her. Instead, the defendant's firmness of criminal purpose is clear from the specific language and context of these telephone conversations. Defendant's motivations were criminal. Defendant stated, "I wouldn't need a lawyer if N-words were moving and doing what they're supposed to be doing. The bitch should be dead already." During that particular phone conversation, the jury then immediately heard the response from his cousin. His cousin stated, "I can't do it for them. I can't make them get busy. You knew who you was dealing with. I can't make them get out there and get busy. I can't definitely get out there and do the type of shit they can do." This response from his cousin was strong circumstantial evidence that someone had been contacted, that someone failed to act, and he had failed to act as commanded. And the cousin was saying to the defendant, "I'm sorry, I can't do anything for you. You knew who you were dealing with." Through defendant's conversations from jail, the state also proved the substantial step element required for a conviction for attempt. By his repeated attempts to follow up as to why the victim was, in his words, still swinging. And continued demands like, he got it down that. Because, man, them bitches are still coming. By presenting defendant's words, the state proved two things. First, a solicitation for murder. And second, that the defendant engaged in certain conduct in furtherance of that solicitation. And just like this court held in State versus Perez, the steps taken by the defendant painted a whole picture to the jury that to allow the jury to infer the defendant ordered the murder of the victim. And his continued follow-up was strongly corroborative of his criminal purpose to ensure that the victim could not show up in court to testify against him. In sum, the evidence presented allowed the jury to conclude that defendant had gone far enough in his planned attempt to ensure the victim would not testify. And the appellate division's reversal in this case improperly replaced the jury's factual findings and implemented its own view of the evidence. By doing so, the appellate division discarded the proper application of State versus Reyes in giving the state the benefit of all of its favorable testimony and the reasonable inferences that could be drawn therefrom, an error that the state urges this court to remedy by reinstating the conviction for the second attempted murder. Your Honors, I've finished my opening statement. I'm ready for any questions the court may have.
Is your position that his direction to his cousin, which you quoted before, the substantial step? I mean, is giving a direction to one person to give a direction to another the lawful equivalent of the substantial step that we need in this kind of context?
Your Honor, I think in certain circumstances, it's the state's position that these calls, that there was at an earlier point in time that the defendant put out an order to kill, and these calls are simply him following up on that and why is she not dead yet and asking third persons to text people and tell them, you know, this has got to be done.
And you get that from his statement that he referenced wanting, I think you said, KG to do something.
Well, to text him off that and tell him I said, yes. I mean, there is definitely direction there. But, Your Honor...
But that's direction at that time. You're suggesting that there was a prior direction?
I believe it's the state's... That there was an inferential step here that has to be done that the jury did take in this case. Mm-hmm. By the call, there's a progression to these phone calls. It starts out with him, you know, first being arrested, and he's talking about how he doesn't think that this victim even gave a statement. He makes the claim that, you know, I was in the hospital room next to her, and she went right into surgery. She didn't make no statement.
Yeah, he can't believe this is unfolding the way that it is.
Right.
That comes across pretty clearly.
Right, and then when she shows up in court, that's when you know these conversations sort of take the turn, and at that point in time, those conversations, there's an inferential step there that he did contact someone, and now he's following up with his cousin and his girlfriend, and he's further demanding that something be done. He's checking up on why she hasn't been killed. Why hasn't this been done?
Is there any suggestion that this person is in some sort of hierarchy where he's in the ability to give a command to someone that must be obeyed? Is that in this record anywhere?
No. Well, Your Honor, if there could be an inference to that, but it doesn't seem as though...
There's nothing direct on
there's
that
no
point.
Direct there. There's an hierarchy, but...
Does this statement, this conversation help your argument? If the men were just moving and doing what they're supposed to be doing, the bitch should have been dead already. Does that suggest that they had already told someone that the bitch should be dead or that...
That is correct, Your Honor.
Does that help your argument?
It does. And I think that him, the defendant here, you know, says lots of things. And he makes demands. He makes inquiries. Mm-hmm. He even says, well, if they're not going to do what they're supposed to be doing, you need to get me out of here so I can handle what I have to handle. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's an arc here that happens in these telephone conversations. Well, there's a progression.
But what if he lives, this person lives in a criminal milieu. There's no question about that. And there's no question, at the very least, he's wishing that this witness, who is about to testify him, will die, and probably a violent death. But are his remarks consistent with his knowledge that he has friends and people who will just do these things for him without his having to say anything? And if that were the case, would he be guilty of attempt?
I would say yes, Your Honor. I would.
So
I,
even if he was sitting back and not saying anything and not directing anyone to do anything,
that would be,
but in the ordinary course, given that he has friends within this criminal circle, they would necessarily do him this favor. Would that constitute criminal attempt?
No, Your Honor. And the reason why is because in that particular instance, the defendant doesn't have a criminal purpose. I would disagree that these are his wishes. These are his demands. These are his commands. This is not simply his wishes. I mean, of course, he hopes that she'll die.
Inmates are aware that their phone calls are monitored, that they're eavesdropped. Is that correct? They're told they're aware of it?
They're told that, yes.
As far as I know, this defendant was reasonable intelligence, reasonable education, reasonably aware of surroundings. Is it logical that he would actually, when conversation would be recorded, would say, kill her? Isn't this just a way of avoiding that while saying it?
That is correct, Your Honor. And that is the danger with this case, because if solicitation, if these types of conversations are not a form of attempt, and they should be for the reasons why, because the state proved the conscious object, the purposefulness. The state proved that he had a criminal purpose. The state proved that his conversations were in corroboration of that criminal purpose. And we proved that he had a firmness of criminal purpose. So
what
in this
is the step? What is the step?
The substantial step in certain circumstances is the actual solicitation. And the
it's simply the words to the people he's speaking who are supposed to convey his sentiments. Is that what you're suggesting?
It's the act, Your Honor. And as this court stated in State versus Perez, the acts and his words in tandem. So you take the act of solicitation, the solicitation of her
murder.
But
the act is his words. I'm trying to break down these two parts because you're talking about them as if they're two different things, but they're the same, aren't they?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe the act of solicitation is separate and apart.
Think about it in terms of the proofs in this case.
Okay.
The proofs come down to the passages that you have referenced. Is that fair? The words that are spoken.
Yes.
So why don't you take a minute and highlight for us which specific passages most strongly demonstrate a substantial step, and if you can, give us citations for those.
Sure, Your Honor. Going back, I think, tell him about the car, tell him what happened with me in court, like he's supposed to, like what the F are people still walking around for. He says he's supposed to, and that is 7T.
Is that July 21st?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't have the date. I just have the citation 70, 221, page 221, lines 3 to 9.
Go ahead.
I think also what's important is he says, I've reached out to him and told him what I need fixed. And that's 80, page 78.
So what follows that? Because the reason why I'm asking that, when you read the transcripts, as I have, there are so many things going on. He's going from one subject to the next subject to this subject to, is there money in the commissary for me? Mm-hmm. Like, I want to buy cigarettes. So when you're saying, I need this fixed, tell me what goes after that. What is the language that I want to make certain what he needs fixed isn't more money in this commissary?
No, that particular, and the defendant does. The defendant does say a lot of things, but I think what's important in this case.
You just gave us this is. You're saying that this is some of the language for the substantial step.
Yes.
I'm giving you an opportunity. That's the statement. Tell us what he says immediately before and immediately after, so that we have that in context.
Your Honor, unfortunately, I don't have my record up here with me. I could go get it for you, but
okay, just give us a citation because we'll be able to.
Okay, yes, Your Honor. For the fixed, the citation is 80, page 78, line 25 to page 80, to line 20. That's the entire.
Okay.
But I think to answer your question, what I think is important about this is the fact that while he does talk about a lot of things, he always comes back to the same thing, which is, why isn't the victim dead yet?
So because this case comes down to the passages, continue down your list of highlighting for us what you think are the most strong proofs of substantial step.
Okay. So again, will you just text him off that and tell him, I said, man, he got it down, that dog. And that is 17, page 244, line 15 to 25.
And you're saying that is a direct order. That's not just a follow-up, aren't people doing what I said? That is, tell him he must kill her.
Yes.
Right there.
Right there, Your Honor. I think also what's important is, I wouldn't need a lawyer. If N-words were moving and doing what they're supposed to be doing, the bitch should have been dead already.
What page was that?
And then the follow-up to that is what his cousin says afterwards, which is, I can't do it for them. That entire citation is AT 41, page 41, line 8 to 16. Again, talking about his repeated attempts to follow up as to why the victim is still swinging and continued demands like he got it down that, and man, them bitches are still coming. The still swinging passage is 8T, page 42, line 16 to page 43, line 4. And then man, them bitches are still coming, that is 7T, page 244, line 15 to 25.
So your argument is that the jury had enough evidence based on his words to infer that he had told somebody to kill them, and that telling the person, ordering them to kill the witness, is the overt act.
That is correct. And then the telephone conversations, the continued follow-up. Your Honors, these jail conversations...
Are you using that to confirm that the overt act was performed, and the jury concluded beyond a reasonable doubt that his words to them confirmed that somebody had been ordered, KG, had been ordered to kill the victim?
That is correct. That is correct.
You admit that the substantial step has to be the direction or order to kill, not the inquiry after, not the inquiry. I mean, because if he doesn't place an order, he still may be inquiring, why is this woman alive?
Right, Your Honor.
And so, so the words, it seems that your best words that you've cited are, well, you just text him off that and tell him, I said, man, he got it down, that dash dog. That to you is a direction?
I would think it's a direction, Your Honor. I think the jury thought it was a direction. I think the jury heard all of these telephone conversations. And, the order, whether it be that particular one or an inference that it was done at a prior point in time, because through these telephone calls, it already seems like, when you read it and put it in context, it already seems like it's been done. And he's following up on it. You got to tell him he's got to down that, you know? I mean, it sounds like something's already in motion.
Counsel, you're relying, as you should, on the fact that the jury did get to hear this and expressed a judgment about it. But in the jury's instruction about attempted murder on this aspect of the case, how was the jury told to evaluate evidence in the form of the words that we're discussing now, vis-a-vis substantial step? Did the court really break it down in any way for the jury to make the assessment that you're asking us to infer from their verdict?
Yes, Your Honor. The jury was given the substantial step, the attempted murder, the substantial step jury instruction.
Well, I'm looking at the jury charge, and I don't see much of anything other than referring to an act or omission constituting a substantial step in the course of conduct planned to culminate in his causing the death of the victim. There's not much teasing out of what substantial step means when we're dealing with words.
Well, and I think, Your Honors, that's important to this case. I think that, you know, a substantial step that's in a course of conduct for the planned attempt. I think those words fit in that language. And I think that's what the jury took the jury instruction. I think they took defendant's words, and they probably did break that down, Your Honor, because if you break that down, the state proved all of that.
Did the state break it down in its summation?
Yes, it did. The state broke down the conversations, why those conversations were important. They actually played the tapes back. They actually played excerpts from the tapes back for the jury during their summation. So, you know, so the jury got to hear, you know, all of the conversations, and then, you know, where the state was making its argument that this was a second attempted murder, the state went back and played those excerpts for the jury.
Did the defendant object to the manner in which the court instructed the jury on how to draw these inferences or about the substantial step requirement?
No, Your Honor. I know there was, throughout the trial, during the playing of the tapes and things like that, the defense did ask for jury instructions to be given beforehand, the fact that these calls are from jail, they weren't to make an adverse inference to that and things like that. So throughout
did the court give those instructions as requested?
And the judge did give those instructions as requested, yes.
That was a different issue that was arising in the case, was it not?
As far as the jail phone calls,
yeah.
There was an instruction that was given that you know, that you're going to hear calls that are from jail because it's in some of the excerpts you can say, you know, jail administration is going to end this call in 2 minutes.
Right, and there was a concern that reference was going to impact negatively on defendants.
Yes. Yes, it didn't necessarily.
It wasn't speaking to this issue.
Yes, to this issue. And again, you know, the jury was given the proper jury instruction in this case. And I think, you know, this jury, they came back pretty quickly with a verdict. And I believe this jury really went back there and deliberated and looked at the jury instruction and said, yes, we do have a substantial step. We do have you know, these phone calls that show that he continued with the plan. He had a criminal motivation, and he continued to follow up with this. And, you know, and an attempt is an incomplete crime. Thankfully here, you know, the victim did not have a second attempt on her life. But the behavior of the defendant, the behavior is culpable and should be culpable for what the defendant did. And, you know, the state feels that a substantial step or that solicitation is a substantial step in certain circumstances. Necessarily, a substantial step analysis is always going to be fact sensitive. Mm-hmm. So the state's not saying that every solicitation in a case would be a substantial step. But in this case, with these facts, there was overwhelming evidence. I did go back and read the transcripts and before this argument. And I went back and I read the sentencing. And right before the sentencing, I think Judge Donio put it best before he sentenced the defendant. He said that, you know, rarely do you have a case with a victim like this. This victim was extraordinary. You know, she was shot 3 times. The defendant had his foot on her chest, shot once in the neck. She survived that. And this victim was not going to be dissuaded from testifying against this defendant. She showed up in court. She knew, she gave a statement. And I think this defendant knew that she was not going to be dissuaded from testifying against him. And, you know, and rarely do we ever have the type of evidence, the state, where you have the defendant's words. I mean, these are his words that the jury is hearing about wanting this person dead and wanting, you know, text him and tell him, I said he's got to down that and I wouldn't need a lawyer, you know, if people were doing what they're supposed to be doing. Because at one point in time, his cousin was like, we got to save money for a lawyer. We can't bail you out. And he's like, I wouldn't need a lawyer. You know, if she was dead, I wouldn't need a lawyer. The state would submit, Your Honors, this was overwhelming evidence. It wasn't just sufficient. It was overwhelming evidence with the defendant's words that a second attempt on this victim's life was attempted.
There's a passage at the end of the appellate division decision on page 32, and I'll just read the sentence. Without evidence of an act by defendant identifying a perpetrator and orchestrating the requisite course of conduct to culminate in the commission of a crime, the state's proofs fall short. Is that level of proof required?
No, Your Honor, I don't. Again, as I argued to this court, what the appellate division basically stated is that the only type of evidence that the state can submit to prove the substantial step element is that of direct evidence. And, you know, this was circumstantial evidence. This was, you know, the defendant's words, although they were overwhelming, there was still an inferential step that a command had been given, and that he was kept following up on that command, kept telling his cousin, call KG, tell him I said he's got to do this. You know, so just like every other crime or element of crimes in our criminal code, the state is able to prove their case with circumstantial evidence. And substantial step in attempted murder should be no different.
The appellate division seems to be suggesting that there is it's impermissible for the jury to draw an inference in these circumstances, although in general, juries can draw inferences from circumstantial evidence. Is that correct?
Certainly, Your Honor. Absolutely. And I believe the appellate division changed the factual landscape of this case when it said that the only inferences that could be drawn were that of his wishes. That's not what the jury heard. That's not what the jury determined. The jury determined that this was, a second attempt on this victim's life. And, you know, you're not always going to have a case where, you know, this particular defendant was in jail. A lot of the case law that we have on substantial step are people that are out on the street. They're able to, case a place, or they're able to get bank records, or like the certain things that we, certain instances that you can point to, solicitation plus in those cases. This defendant's in jail. All he had was his words. That's all he had. And those words were powerful. And the state submits that the evidence in this case, the state proved all that it needed to prove. It proved the defendant's state of mind. It proved the substantial step. It proved that he had conduct in furtherance of that substantial step. It proved his criminal purpose. We know that he didn't want this victim to show up in court and testify. And as this court said in State versus Perez, the jury is able to use their common sense and listen to those phone calls and make reasonable inferences. And I would say, Your Honors, that it is reasonable inferences that were drawn here based on what the defendant said.
Is there any argument, because this language is in such code and street lingo, that he possibly could be talking about paying her off? And the reason why I'm saying, because the strongest language you have is get it down that dash. But when you keep on reading it, he talks about, I'm talking recklessly on the phone, and then you go a couple pages, you're going to have to get in touch with the bank truck you heard. Yeah, what is that? I mean, this is in the same stream of consciousness. Like, what does all that mean? Do you know? Do you have what are we supposed to make of that? It's part of the same dialogue.
Well, Your Honor, I think...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay.
That's on page 220. You're familiar with this. Yeah. You've read the transcripts. Go ahead.
I believe it's really important to put the conversations in context. And, this defendant it is a stream of consciousness. He talks about, he'll go from one subject to the next. At one point in time, he was talking about, his case or whatever, and then he stopped and he says, "Oh, are you going on that job interview?" So, I just think
how do you know that is like a contract to kill rather than like someone paying off money? He's talking about, have you contacted the bank truck? Like, what is that?
Your Honor, I wish I knew exactly what that was. I don't know. I mean, most people don't contact a bank truck if they need money. I don't know if it meant that, he has to steal money. I don't, it might mean a lot of things.
How do we know that down that is some is conveying directions to execute someone as opposed to paying off someone?
How about this part?
Answer that question and then respond to Justice Fernandez Vina. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
Because, Your Honor, I think while there is a lot of sort of code, they're discombobulated. The conversations are all over the place, okay? But there are certain things that don't need, that are not in code, that were plain English, were clear. I wouldn't need a lawyer if N-words were moving and doing what they're supposed to be doing. The bitch should be dead already. That does not need interpretation. That is clear. That is clear language. And that's probably, Your Honor, what stuck out with the jury. The thing about the bank truck and whatever, they probably didn't pay that no never mind. They heard those words. They heard, you got to down that. And, This case was in 2015. It was tried in 2015, and we live in a world of social media. We live in a world of text messaging. We live in a world where we do a lot of abbreviations for things. And so, OMG, LOL on text messages. And so, to say that a jury in 2015 didn't know what you got to down that dog, I don't I don't agree with that. I think the jury knew exactly what the defendant was saying. I don't think that's code. I think it's pretty explicit. And I believe that the jury heard that and completely understood what he was saying.
But in a related area, we have said sometimes it's necessary to have expert testimony in connection with code direction given in a gang setting, and we've permitted expert testimony. Mm-hmm. Is there any comparison to that kind of coded language to what we have going on here?
I don't think so. I don't think so, Your Honor. And I would, you know, it would be speculation to say what could have happened if such a thing had happened. But I suspect that if the state wanted to, because this really wasn't too convoluted, again, a lot of these statements that defendant makes is very clear. It's plain English. There's no code in it.
But the key point that you asked the jury to draw and you're asking us to agree with is that within that coded language was enough of an indication that a prior command had been given, that it was not being given now to this person with whom he was directly speaking.
Well,
he was not asking the person he was speaking to on the phone to go out and kill AA.
No, because his cousin even specifically stated, I can't do what they can do. I can't get busy. I can't do the kind of stuff that they can do.
But there is a request for a reminder. Get the message out there. Yes. She should be dead.
Yes.
And you earlier read that to us.
Yes.
So there's not only just the sort of inference that there was a past command, but there is at least one instance where he is saying, something's going wrong here. Tell him the following.
Yeah. You just text him and tell him I said, man, he got it down that. And that's a command.
And we should assume that that's a command that must be enforced.
Well, Your Honor, I think for an attempt, I don't think that the state needs to prove that he had some sort of authority to do it. I think the fact that the defendant had a conscious object, the purposeful conduct, I think the defendant had a criminal purpose to ensure she didn't testify. The defendant, then the phone calls or conduct and furtherance of that solicitation, that's a criminal motivation. And this court has held that, you know, a jury can then make the determination as to whether or not that is criminal. So under the attempt law, as I know it, the state doesn't have to prove that he has some sort of authority, that he has some sort of people out there that will take care of it.
But when we look at some past attempt cases that dealt with solicitation, there were other acts that had been involved where the person had, you know, offered a specific amount of money or taken someone to a site to explore the building that was to be perhaps burned down. We have something more concrete to show acts in furtherance, substantial steps in furtherance, in addition to the stated command or desire or request that criminal action be done by another.
That is true, Your Honor, and that is what's significant about this case. This defendant was in jail. He didn't have access to his bank records. He didn't have access to the outside world. He couldn't follow her and see where she was going. He couldn't, you know, meet with people to say, hey, I'll pay you. And we don't have those telephone conversations. We don't know if they exist. They very well could. We just don't have them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the difference here is that, you know, this defendant is incarcerated and all he has is his words. And his words in this case, under these facts, are very powerful.
Anything else you'd like to add? We'll have you back for rebuttal later.
Okay. No. Thank you, Your Honor.
Very good. Ms. Sidnikova.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. If I could briefly address the questions the court posed to the state before I make my argument. To address Justice Albin's question about whether or not there could be potentially a different reading of defendant's phone calls, that he maybe wanted her paid off or some other kind of quid pro quo situation. Even if the jury could draw an alternative inference, it doesn't mean that this particular inference could not be drawn. This court actually stated before that, I'm sorry, that the jury may draw an inference from the fact whenever it is more probable than not that the inference is true, and that the veracity of each inference need not be proven beyond a reasonable doubt for the jury to draw this inference. So to basically, even if the defendant wanted to pay it off, it did not preclude the jury from drawing an inference that he wanted actually to have her murdered. To answer Justice Lavecchia's question about the requirement of additional steps, so far the case law that we do have in this state, defendant had solicitation plus some additional actions taken. First of all, we don't have the law that requires that it has to be solicitation and some additional steps. It's just what we have. But also, we don't know that it didn't happen in this situation since in this case the evidence is circumstantial and the jury was drawing the inferences from the facts, we can reasonably infer that the situation did take place, that there was some sort of quid pro quo, that he did offer somebody money or something else in exchange of having the victim killed.
I know what you're saying about the inferences, because we're in a judgment NOV. But if the jury had before two reasonable inferences, how would they be able to find the two inferences? How would they be able to find him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt? If they said this is just as likely as that, both are equally likely, how would they be able to find him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of attempted murder?
Well, in this situation, I would say that it was more likely that defendant wanted the victim killed, judging by the circumstances of the case, that he already did try to kill her by shooting her four times, that he contacted her and trying to dissuade her from testifying, which did not work, and the victim still came forward to court. In this situation, having the victim killed is the most reasonable inference that to be drawn from defendant's conversations, from his continuous demands that somebody down that she should have been dead already, that why are people still swinging, why are people still walking around for. This is definitely not a demand for payoff. This is a demand for murder.
The jury was properly instructed as to the burden on the state, so if they found this to be the inference that they took, should we presume that they considered the state to have met that burden?
We presume that the jury properly follows the instructions given by the court. I would also like to point out that this court in Perez stated that ruling on Reyes' motion, the trial judge has to consider the tandem of facts and words of defendant in considering the whole picture from which the jury will draw its inferences. And considering the totality of the evidence in this case and defendant's acts, defendant's words, defendant's prior attempt to have AA killed, a reasonable jury could have concluded that the defendant had a strong criminal purpose and that he took a substantial step which was corroborated by this criminal purpose. And as we said, the jury did find defendant guilty of attempted murder based on the phone calls. And the trial judge also, in denying defendant's race motion, pointed out that given all the reasonable inferences to the state, the jury could have drawn the inference from the phone calls that defendant ordered the execution, the murder of AA, that the substantial step was taken, and that he was upset and frustrated that his orders were not carried out, and that was enough for the case to go to the jury. And subsequently, the appellate division erroneously substituted its judgment for that of the jury by finding that reasonable jury could not draw the inference and convict defendant of the attempted murder based on the phone calls.
Thank you, counsel.
Swanson.
Good morning, Your Honor. Defendant's conviction for first-degree attempted murder was based on his words alone to his cousin and his girlfriend while he was in jail. From those words, one could reasonably conclude that he wanted the victim in the underlying case dead and that he was enraged that she was still alive. However, the cousin and the girlfriend made it very clear that they had no way to compel that result, and neither did defendant. That's the overall tenor of these phone calls. The state's case rested entirely on these phone calls. The AG has conceded that there was no recorded conversation of defendant actually asking or ordering someone to kill AA. Now, the phone calls occurred in February and March of 2014. From that time until trial in July 2015, no one did anything consistent with these phone calls. There's no additional action that corroborates that the purpose of these phone calls was to follow up on some plan. In light of this, the appellate division correctly held that the state failed to prove the defendant had taken a substantial step toward the commission of first-degree murder. This court should affirm that decision. The requirement of a substantial step, strongly corroborative of criminal purpose, is a critical safeguard against punishing people for criminal thoughts or even evil thoughts. Wanting someone dead and wishing that someone would do that on your behalf is not first-degree attempted murder. Now, moving to the state's position that they did not get the favorable inferences to which they were entitled, so let's assume that they were entitled to that inference, and that inference is that defendant had ordered someone to kill AA either directly or indirectly. This would still not be enough under the law for a substantial step. Defendant did none of the things that the case law has identified as a substantial step in this context. He didn't enlist someone to commit the crime. No weapon was provided. He didn't discuss or agree about payment. There was no plan or the terms of the agreement. He didn't provide any pertinent logistical information. He didn't propose ways to execute this murder or to avoid police detection. And the state doesn't dispute that none of these steps were taken. So what the state is contending here is what we call a naked solicitation, the mere fact of asking someone to commit an offense on your behalf. That's not by definition a substantial step. And the Attorney General's position that solicitation, the form of solicitation that we're talking about here is something that was once a misdemeanor offense pre-code. The state is contending that that's now a first degree attempted murder. That's not supported by the statutory language. That's not supported by the precedents in this state on the solicitation. And it's a minority position across the country because it's a bad policy to equate these two distinctly analytically different offenses to one another. Therefore, this court should reject that position and reaffirm that when there's a theory that of attempted murder based on solicitation, there must be evidence of the solicitation and substantial steps taken in furtherance of that. And that concludes my preliminary statement.
Well, these are all fact-specific cases, of course, as you point out, and you've suggested that the existing case law has stronger fact patterns. Is it really your position that if you have a recording of an individual ordering someone to kill another person, that that could not constitute a substantial step without more?
I think as a general matter, it doesn't constitute a substantial step because it's a remote preparatory act. If no details have been agreed upon, if there is no payment or any plan, it's just saying, will you please do this for me? There has to be more because the...
How do you get that from the language of the statute?
Okay. The language of the statute says, purposely does or omit to do anything which under the circumstances a reasonable person would believe them to be is an act or omission constituting a substantial step. People say a lot of awful things and people express a lot of awful wishes. The mere fact of asking someone to do that, I wouldn't expect that if I say please kill so-and-so, that would be a substantial step that a reasonable person would interpret as that is necessary to get us beyond the sort of, you know, the latent inactive phase into someone activating this.
Fair enough. I think if you said please do it, I think we wouldn't be looking at that case. But now look at it in the context here,
okay,
in a light most favorable to the state, where you have someone who acted in a way attempting to kill this individual. Assume such a person ordered an individual to kill another individual. Not enough as a matter of law?
We would have to know the circumstances of that. We don't know what defendant's status is in his community, nor do we know who these orders were issued to. If this defendant was in a gang and this was a reasonable expectation that all you have to say is please execute this plan, then that would be a different
case. Is that necessary that someone be the head of a leader of a gang? Could an individual such as myself say, you know, I want you to kill so-and-so, but I'm not a leader of a gang. I'm not even the leader of this court. The chief is.
I'm not suggesting
would that be something that could be prosecuted or convicted of?
I'm not suggesting that that's necessary. What I'm saying is that when you have a very simple solicitation, those additional circumstances that shows that this is some sort of special milieu, this person has this status, like that changes the nature of the solicitation. Here we don't have a direct...
How about fear?
Excuse me?
He's already attempted to kill this person. People know he's a violent person. Is that sufficient? The fear that that person may kill you if you don't act in the way in which he or she wishes?
Well,
is that sufficient?
There is no question the defendant had a motive to kill this victim. No one is contesting that.
Oh, no, I'm not talking about motive to kill perhaps a person that doesn't obey his orders.
Well, we don't know anything about defendant's status and that. We know that
talking status. I'm just talking personality.
I don't know anything about defendant's personality. I know that defendant did an awful thing, and he was punished for that first-degree attempted murder. But I don't know that we can
concerned that if he told me, you better kill somebody, and I already know he's tried to kill a few people, would that motivate me, whether he was a head of a gang or not? Just knowing that he's done what you just suggested,
knowing
terrible acts?
Well, we would have to know who he's directing this to. You know, in his conversations, he goes back between the singular and the plural if people were doing what they were supposed to do. Like, I don't know if it's directed to a group or a person. We have to make up a lot of facts to get to the idea that he can merely make this request or this order and then people will activate it.
So that sounds like a good argument to present to a jury, but we're at a stage of reviewing the sufficiency of the evidence after a JNOV, and the evidence must be looked at in a light most favorable to the state now. How do you account for that?
Well, because at most in this case, we do have a solicitation, and the case law has says that it has to be a solicitation and additional acts in furtherance thereof. And
so if you have someone who is incarcerated, can't go out there and do this himself, and he solicits someone to kill a witness who he wants to, he's already tried to kill, that is an act that cannot be punished criminally because he doesn't have the ability to go out there and plan more specifically or be part of the actual event?
Well, many of the solicitation cases in New Jersey and across the country, it is someone who is in jail and he doesn't have the means to go out there and do certain things, but that doesn't prevent you from taking additional steps. Ursinoli, which was cited in my brief, that's the 1990 Appellate Division case, that's a case where the defendant was in jail, and that's a case where he wanted someone else to kill his uncle who would have been the main witness in a trial. So very similar set of circumstances. And this is what he did. He solicited a person, and then he took these additional steps to make it very clear that I want this thing to be done, and I'm going to enable you to do that by providing you with critical information. And what
directions
he did,
and specifics about the person's habits and so forth.
Yes, and he also assured them that I had the means to pay for this.
Yeah.
And he showed the bank account, and he provided his additional contact information and proposed several methods by which we should carry this out. Because, you know, you have these phone calls, there's this venting, there's this ranting, and many things that sometimes you can take it literally, and it may possibly support an interpretation that he wanted someone to kill AA. But what moves the venting and the ranting to a solicitation and substantial step is when there's detail and there's content to the plan.
Okay, so you concede that he hopes that some will kill her. That much you concede, right?
Yes.
So it seems to me the most damaging statement is on page 224 of the July 16th transcript, where the defendant says, well, you just text him off of that and tell him I said he got to down that / dog. And then the unidentified female says, my phone, I'm going to text him on the iPad. So taking those two together, that can one reasonably infer, got to down that / dog is to kill the person, and then the person to whom he is speaking is saying, okay, I'll text that person, pass that along. Go ahead, I'm giving you a chance. Is that an unreasonable inference?
I try to Google down that S-word dog. It doesn't come up. I don't know what that means. Sort of to say to down something may sometimes mean to lock it down or solidify a plan. So I'm not conceding what that means.
Well, the next line is this, and pardon my language. So this shit is just, he got to down that. F that man, them bitches is coming. She keep talking all this. I mean, so that's putting it in context, that it seems that he's concerned about someone coming to court, perhaps, and talking.
But the segment that precedes the well, you have to text him off of that and tell him I said, it's something that I don't understand.
You don't understand? You had a Google shit dog?
Well, I'm assuming that there was a pause between
you had
shit
the
and dog.
You had the Google shit dog?
No,
you
I
have
I
no
mean,
idea
I
what
Googled
that could have
the
meant?
Phrase, he got it down. This is the overarching problem in this case, is that there's no competent evidence about defendant's words. And so some of these words, he's obviously speaking figuratively. You know, the state has now identified KG as the person who is supposed to execute this. I know that this is a raised standard motion, and what we're interested in is looking at this record, but I think it's pretty revealing that KG has only appeared as the boogeyman in the appellate court. This was not something that was argued to the jury, and it was not argued that the motion for a judgment of acquittal, when the trial judge said, what is your most compelling evidence of this? They cited the passage about if the N-words were doing what they were supposed to be doing. There was never any theory that a specific person had been identified as a person who was supposed to execute this plan.
But that the evidence was all before the jury that they are now pointing to on this argument. I mean, it's not like there's something that wasn't submitted to the jury that is now being argued.
No, I understand that. I only highlight that fact to talk about sort of how dubious it is. It's a theory that is now here for the first time. It wasn't one that was presented before.
Is the question?
Not, I'm sorry, Justice Solomon.
No, it's not just the theory. Forget KG for a minute, but the names, the initials are in there. If they were doing what they were supposed to be doing, the jury could infer that he had told somebody to do something. It's a reasonable inference. And I thought one of the state's arguments was that his words, not just once, not just twice, but over and over and over again, were that he told somebody to take out this witness. And the jury had everything in front of them, including what he had already done himself. And they made a reasonable inference.
I think he had an expectation that this witness wouldn't show up to court, and that I don't know
if that's what he said.
No, this witness wouldn't be testifying, and that someone would kill her. But there isn't reasonable evidence here that he directed an order. It's just like, this is how things are supposed to work. Like, people are not supposed to be showing up to court, and people are supposed to be doing things.
That's an argument, good closing argument. Jury didn't buy. They heard his words, they heard his voice, they heard his repeated references, even heard the reference to KG. And they heard the arguments of counsel, and they said, reasonable inference, we conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that he took a substantial step to have this witness killed. So I get your argument. I'm not saying it's not a rational defense,
but
just jury didn't buy it.
I think taking everything together, taking all of these statements and what happens after, which is nothing.
But like wait a minute, you don't have to get the witness killed.
No, I'm not suggesting that the witness needed to be killed. I'm assuming that if we're to assume that there was this order placed to have her murdered, we don't have any conversations defining the terms of that at all, and we don't have anyone who's doing anything consistent with what is supposed to be this order.
The whole argument, I thought, was it had already been done. Whatever you're saying should have been in this conversation had already been done. He's in jail, doesn't have a ton of time, probably under a fair amount of stress, and wants this thing dealt with. It's already been done. Already set it up, whatever. This person, KG, whoever it was, take care. Make sure that they do what they were supposed to be doing. I thought that's the whole argument. You wouldn't expect them to be doing something now that's already been done, or redoing it, or re-explaining it. I thought that was the argument. And by the way, you're making a reasonable counter-argument. Jury just didn't buy it. Why? We're not the jury. We're an appellate court.
I think I'm pretty concerned with the idea that we're going to take some of these words that are inscrutable at face value. We don't have the girlfriend, we don't have the cousin testifying. We have just a defendant who's sometimes ranting. He's using inexact language. He's using slang terms, and we're going to say that these specific passages mean this precise thing, and then other passages that can contradict that, that suggest that he's just generally concerned with what people are not doing, not
finish your answer.
Okay, not a specific person or not following up on an order. And I think one of the last passages here is, I think it's his girlfriend telling him that basically, whatever you think is going to happen, we have no control over anyone. They're not shooting anyone, and you're damn sure they're not shooting no females. They're getting ready to go to jail for shooting a female because you got beat up. Are you serious? I mean, that really undermines this idea that there was this firm order and that he had the authority to issue orders for someone out there to commit a crime.
Why is authority, we keep coming back to this, why is authority part of the state's burden? If somebody wants to have their wife killed or husband killed, and they make a phone call, and whoever the proposed hitman is doesn't think there's enough money or doesn't really want to get involved with this and just simply ignores it, that person can still be convicted of an attempt. Correct?
Authority is relevant in this case because we don't know who is supposed to do this, and basically the state's theory is that he issued an order or made a request,
but we have nothing
about the context of that, and so people can desire many things, but if you haven't taken any additional steps to ensure that someone will actually act on this order, then it's he's saying a number of things from prison, and everyone is saying no one has control over the situation. So unless we knew something in particular about who he is in the community, and why these people would do anything on his behalf.
So a request to someone to kill someone on your behalf is not enough if you aren't either offering enough money or have the authority to make people do something they might otherwise not do. Where is that in the law?
We get it from the precedents in New Jersey where we have solicitation, and we get it from the plain meaning of what a substantial step is. It's in terms of thinking of the sequence of what one might do if you want someone to kill another on your behalf, you'd probably form the intent to do so, and then the next thing you do is say, hey, can you do this? And then without an agreement, without details, without plans, without money, without weapon, it doesn't get you to a substantial step. The case law says remote preparatory steps are not enough. And we know that's the majority position across the country.
You mentioned details, and in the case you cited, the one involving the uncle, there was information that had to be conveyed about the uncle, where he'd be, the location, the directions, and all of that, because the person being solicited was not familiar with the uncle. For all we know, there were no details necessary to get this done that he needed to provide based on whoever it is that he may have asked to do this. So to say that the fact that that other case involved details and that was important means that in order to be convicted of attempt, you have to provide the directions, the this, the that, the money, show the bank account. I don't see that in the law. I think that existed in that case in part because in order to have the uncle killed, the logistics had to be worked out. But if the logistics don't have to be worked out in a particular case, why isn't simply enough to ask that a solicitation is enough?
In this case, we don't have any information about who he wants to do this. So we have to just sort of infer that whoever is supposed to kill the victim knows the victim is a part of this community. That information, we just have to speculate about that. The state hasn't These phone calls don't provide that information.
Wasn't his first contact with the victim, well, he's in jail, she was there visiting another inmate, he took the phone away from the inmate to tell her she better drop it. So can we assume from that that she was known in the community? Because she was in jail visiting someone else, not him, and he took the phone from the inmate. That was his first contact. So can we assume that he wasn't a stranger coming from Philadelphia or New York, that she was known in the community?
That contact with the victim comes 6 months after these phone calls, where he's apparently.
Oh, no, but that was the point of my question. My question is, she was there visiting someone, so we can assume she was known in the community. She knew people in the community, including another inmate.
Yeah, and then we have to assume that whoever was supposed to carry out this order was also known in the community, and he didn't have to provide any information, nor did he have to provide any consideration or money or no quid pro quo that somehow. I say this.
Is money required, consideration, in order to be convicted?
Money is not required, but I think money is a pretty critical step. Well, if you have a murder-for-hire case, most people aren't going to
expose
themselves.
This wasn't a murder-for-hire. Can we agree this was not a murder-for-hire? This is a murder to get him out of jail?
I don't know what this was. I don't know, because we don't know who has been solicited.
But what do you think his purpose was, if it was not to avoid the witness?
I think that defendant... Like most defendants, you don't want the person, the main witness against you, testify, and I think he did want her to be killed, but then we don't know about who was supposed to do it and why that person would do it for him. But so if you just say...
Is that a requirement under the statute?
It's not a requirement, but I think it would be critical in establishing the substantial step here, because that changes the nature of the solicitation.
Do we need to know the precise nature of the solicitation? Because when we're dealing with attempt, we need to know the crime that was being attempted. The state charged this defendant with attempted murder, whereas a lot of the statements that we're looking at are intimidating statements to deter testimony. Is that part of the public defender's position, that we need to know more about the precise steps and furtherance of this act in order to have the context that supports the state's proofs for solicitation of an attempt?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Does that fit with the commentary discussion of the model, the New Jersey Penal Code Commission, when they were drafting this rule, and it was, of course, changed somewhat when the legislature adopted it, to consider solicitation as part of a substantial step that could be taken for an attempt, changing New Jersey law?
That is consistent, and Jovanovic goes through the history of
it
the
does.
Penal code, and we know that solicitation existed as a misdemeanor, mm-hmm. and then when we change our attempt statute, we follow the model penal code's conception of solicitation by requiring a substantial step for this component, attempt. And the model penal code specifically advised that general solicitation continue to exist as a separate offense.
Well, in the commentary, it says, as a caveat to considering solicitation as a substantial step, it says that it says provided a true solicitor can be convicted if there's sufficient findings both as to the specificity of the conduct solicited as well as the actor's purpose to protect against unwarranted prosecutions. The first of those two points goes to the importance of the additional acts or what we know of them in order to understand if it meets the standard for a substantial step. It's always a fact-based analysis.
Yes.
As we know from past cases.
Yes. So they're very concerned about sort of a situation like this, where someone would say, do something, and we don't have the details. Mm-hmm. I think I have the exact quote, by the making of sufficient findings as to both the specificity of the conduct solicited and the actor's purpose, unwarranted prosecutions would be guarded against.
Mm-hmm. So don't we have more at this phase of the case, again, looking at the evidence in a light most favorable to the state, more than simply do something? And there are two passages I wanted you to respond to. You covered the first. If I wouldn't need a lawyer, if they were moving and doing what they were supposed to be doing, the person, quote, should have been dead already. So we know what the something is. It's killing. It's death. And then on page 66, same transcript, if you're not going to handle the situation, get me back out so I can. Doesn't that suggest a reasonable inference is that they're talking about killing and that there was a prior discussion about killing?
I'm sorry, if you're not going, the first passage was if you're not going
to. The second passage in particular. I'm looking at page 66, line 16. If you're not going to handle the situation, get me back out so I can handle the situation. Isn't it fair to infer from his words what he's talking about here, more than simply doing something?
Yeah, I think it's fair to infer that he's saying that I can't get people to act on my own behalf and to do my bidding, and so I want to be out on bail so I can do it myself.
So that's one way to look at it. That's certainly not the light most favorable to the state. Would you agree?
Maybe not for that particular passage, but then all the other passages where it's very clear that he's upset with people generally. Upset that people are generally not carrying this out.
So I want to give a historical reference. Long ago, Henry II was having this great conflict with the top cleric in England, Thomas Becket, and
he remembers it well.
Among his retainers, he said, "Will no one rid me of this meddlesome priest?" And the retainers went off, and they killed Becket. Would that be a murder case?
Is that sort of code like that? What?
Good for you.
It was then.
I'm glad you thought of that.
Well, that may be a murder case because there's a specific relationship and an expectation, and because of the hierarchy that he had, then he can expect that someone would execute his wishes on his behalf. But that's what's missing in this case, that this defendant can say something from jail to his cousin and his girlfriend and that people will act on his behalf.
I think we have your position. Is there anything you'd like to add?
Yes. In closing, I just want to reiterate that the substantial step requirement is an attempt to balance two competing interests, the individual's liberty interest with the state's interest in deterring crime. An individual should not be prosecuted or punished for an attempt unless he is firmly advanced towards that goal. The defendant in this case did not cross that threshold. He had a series of conversations with intimate family members where no plan was devised and no subsequent acts occurred, and that didn't firmly advance the goal of having the victim kill. And I just want to reiterate that there is a First Amendment right and constitutional room for defendant to say deplorable and awful things. And that is protected until it veers into the place where he is making plans and propelling the solicitation forward. So for that reason, defendant respectfully requests that the appellate division's decision be affirmed.
Thank you. Ms. Harrigan, did you want to offer a rebuttal?
No, briefly.
Your Honors, briefly, I just wanted to speak to solicitation is a substantial step. My opposing counsel said it was bad policy to equate solicitation with substantial step, but what we have to remember here is the defendant's criminal purpose, and that the strongly corroborative of the actor's criminal purpose in the substantial step requirement protects against criminal liability for idle requests that are not meant to be taken seriously.
Can I ask you a question on that idle? Had the witness actually been killed by some unknown person, would you have charged the defendant with murder, and could you have convicted him?
Well, I think there's a lot of things there that would have to, be known first.
I'm actually basing all of this on the transcript, because dealing with all the unknowns here, we don't know who's talking to who and all that. And this is an attempted murder, which is a lesser offense of murder. So assume that she was actually shot and killed. Mm-hmm. Would you be able to mount a murder conviction, a murder prosecution?
I believe we would, Your Honor, and here's why.
Go ahead.
Because there's been a lot of talk about he doesn't have a hierarchy and, you know, he didn't have authority or things like that. But what is present in this record and what the victim testified to in this case is she's known this defendant since childhood. The woman whose house it was, where the shooting was, they were friends since childhood. And so you have a community here that these people are in, that they all know each other. And so if someone, let's say KG had killed the victim.
Some unknown person. Because we don't know who's doing what here. If she winds up shot, okay, mm-hmm. and killed, you're saying that defendant could have been successfully convicted of murder based upon these conversations?
Your Honor, that's a difficult question to answer only because based on what the circumstances of the shooting were, link it?
Why can't you I know it's difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that you would be saying yes.
Because
you're saying that this is attempted murder. And if this is attempted murder, then you should be able to convict murder. But yet I see you hesitating about the murder.
Well, because if we had an actual murder, we would have other evidence than we have in an
attempted
murder.
You'd have an investigation and find out if somebody else
right.
was
we would,
involved.
Right, and that's why I'm saying, you'd have to still be able to link that murder to the defendant. I'm not going to say that we would be able to convict the defendant on a murder based on what's said here. I think it would be a strong suspect that, and then at that point in time, the defendant would be an accomplice because the crime would have been committed.
Your answer is, yes.
Yes.
You'd have enough to charge, and the jury would make the decision based on the strength of the arguments both sides present.
Based on what the investigation, and if you could link that murder to the defendant, yes, I agree. So, again, briefly, they were all part of a community, and so, the criminal purpose here is clear, that he wanted the victim dead. And so substantial step and the requirements for the substantial step protect a defendant against the idle threats, as my opposing counsel spoke to. And just real quick, the KG argument. The state did not just simply bring up the KG argument to this court. The KG argument and that particular text was first argued by the state during the original Reyes motion. That is the quote that the state used because the judge, Judge Donio, in the Reyes motion said, state, what's your substantial step? And so the state brought forward the KG argument. Also, in the sentencing transcript, in the motion for the JNOV, the judge brings up the KG text and says, this is what, this is strong evidence that the state has. And so, KG has always been part of the case. It's always been argued in this case, and it's not something that simply was brought up for this court.
Thank you to all.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement. Court's in recess till 1:00.